Okay, so let's look at just a function. Check passphrase, so as the name implies, right, we're trying to essentially check a password. Look okay? So we're assuming that we have global or internal variable passphrase, right? And we're comparing this versus string. And basically we just iterate through it, right? If while the characters match, we keep going, right? Until we get to the null character at the end. Okay? And then we return whether or not sort of all the characters match, right? So if we hit somewhere where they didn't match, then this last return statement will return false. You buy that? Any issues with this? Yeah?
If passphrase is longer than versus, you can get
it. Okay, yeah, if passphrase is longer than versus, so the end of versus should be null, and then passphrase won't have a null character in the middle of it, right? So it'll still match as not the same, right? So we should still exit. Because that just looks like they weren't the same. Anyone think of any issues here? So this is a reasonable implementation from sort of a like correctness point of view. But the implementation itself is sort of bad. Now why is it bad? Well, because this while loop is going to execute sort of until it finds a mismatch. So what does that mean? The more characters that are correct, even if they don't match, the longer this will take. And so even if we don't know what that internal passphrase is, but if we call this function, we notice that it takes longer to execute than other runs. Well, that sort of tells us like we must be onto something. You see that? And if it exit returns very quickly, then we must have maybe the first character is in fact wrong. So you wouldn't think that just checking the password should tell you what the password is, and it doesn't exactly, but it does give you some idea. That makes sense? Any questions? Okay, so why is this a problem? Well, what if we guess some password and probably do it in some sort of systematic way? We're going to just change the first letter and then leave the other letters the same, and we call check password. Now, there must be a correct first character, and so when we hit the correct first character, and we try this a bunch of times, well, that iteration, in this case the DAAAA, takes a little bit longer than all of the others. Why? Because the others returned immediately, and the one where we had the correct match had to execute that while loop again. And so, okay, so now we say, okay, well, it must have been D, so let's try the next character, right? So we'll try D as the first character for all of them, and then vary the second character, and do the same thing. Now, there's going to be noise, different... all the things we've been talking about during the semester, right? But if we try this enough and take enough measurements, we should see the one that's correct and the second character is going to take a little bit longer. And so we continue this process until we've essentially kind of brute forced the password out by trying different options and then seeing which one takes the most time. So again, correct code, right? It won't return true unless you have the right password, except it does a little bit more than the programmer intended. We can look at a different example. So we talked about secure channels and cryptography, right? We're going to use these math functions in a very specific way to give us nice security properties, authenticity, confidentiality, things like that. Well, to make that actually secure and hard to guess, we need to use big numbers. Because smaller numbers, we could essentially get brute force with today's computers. Larger numbers, that's intractable. And so a lot of cryptography libraries have to use, or are trying to multiply or do operations on large numbers. Now, hardware doesn't generally directly support that. And so to multiply, say, two really large numbers, we can implement this by sort of breaking it down into parts. So if we have two large integers, or two reasonably large integers, with the product, we could get up to 128 bits. Well, if our multiply instruction can only output 64-bit products, we can't just directly multiply those two. But that's okay, right? We can break down each of the operands here into sort of its upper and lower portions, right? We do that for both of them. And then if we just multiply X and Y and multiply through, right, we're going to end up with, well, the operation we want is over here, and basically we're going to end up with the addition of these four smaller multiplies. Now, each one of those multiplies we can do on our hardware, and then we can add them up, and then we'll get our desired product. All right, so I think if it doesn't quite like immediately make sense, I think you could look at this a little longer and be like, oh, right, yeah. Anyways. But, and then we can sort of keep doing this idea, right? So if we wanted larger than 64 bits, we can keep going on smaller hardware. But again, right, this idea that we're going to take the problem and then break it up into a different number of executions, so a different number of operations we have to do. Well, if we can observe how many operations happened, that can tell us something about the actual calculation that's happening, even if we can't observe it directly. Right, so in this case, we don't have sort of visibility into the crypto library. We can just observe what's happening when it's called, and probably we can sort of get it to be called. Right? We can do something that's going to require this operation, even if we can't actually see what the operation is actually doing. But we sort of observe it through this other method. And so based on how long something takes, as sort of a proxy for how many operations, that tells us something about what's actually going on. Now, maybe in some multiplications this doesn't matter, but again, in the cryptography case, where the operation might depend on, say, the private key, which, again, remember, has to be kept secret, well, that could be a problem. Because again, we get sort of this window into what's going on and possibly a way to reveal something that should have been secret. And we're not just reading the key directly, we're sort of observing the effect of using a particular key and how that corresponds to how long an operation takes or the timing of that operation. And so a lot of these attacks came from academic research. So this example from Brumley and Bonet in 2003, looking at sort of exactly this type of issue. That by noticing how OpenSSL is implemented, they could launch an attack like this where they were trying to observe the timing and then figure out what the private key is based on that. And the key is that the execution speed, or how long these operations took internally, right, the multiplication, the modulus operations, depended on the input and the private key. Well, guess who controls the input? The attacker, in this case. Right, because the attacker can sort of ask for a certain operation to happen, or a certain encryption to happen, or try to start a connection in a certain way, and then they choose what they send. Then the library goes, okay, well, I know what to do with that. I'm going to take my private key and do some operation. I'm not going to tell you my private key, but I'm just going to do this operation and send you back the result, and that's fine, except if the timing changes, depending on how these relate, you can figure out what's going on. And so in the paper, there's this graph, which won't go through all the details here, but basically speaking, on the y-axis here is time difference. So depending on whether or not there was a 1 or a 0 in the private key, led to an observable difference in the execution time. And so by trying enough times, eventually they're able to guess enough of the bits of the key to the point where they can figure out the entire key. So, and this was on, like, again, this wasn't sort of, you know, this was on, like, the real OpenSSL, right, the library that everyone uses for cryptographic operations. And then even more importantly, it wasn't even on the local machine, right? They were doing this over a local network, right? And so this effect was pronounced enough that even with extra delays from, like, the network and two different machines, with enough trials, you can still sort of observe these effects. Any questions? So these are sort of timing attacks. Another sort of version of this type of issue is we can sort of see from a browser, even a simple browser example. Right, so what's a goal of a browser? It's essentially to provide like a little mini machine for every web page. And so that allows you to open multiple websites and run code from multiple websites. And they really shouldn't interact, right? It's sort of like we don't want two different web pages to be able to sort of learn about each other. Really, we want those to be separate. So, for example, we don't want one website to learn about all the other websites that you've been to and just kind of be able to just pull that information. But even this sort of simple example, right, we see all the time where, you know, we have a link, right, and it's a different color, right, and we kind of know what that means, right? Okay, so this one's, you know, this darker color, so that's something we've already clicked on. Well, if a web page can just put a bunch of links in there, the browser will then color them for us so we can tell, like, wait a minute, is that something I've clicked on before or not? Oh, it's new. Okay, I'll try that. And then if that same web page can then run some JavaScript to then check, like, wait, which color did the browser make that? And did it format it somehow? Meaning that it was taken, you know, it's been clicked before? Oh, okay. Well, so now I know, you know, at some point the user clicked this link. Right, I'll make a note of that. So this sort of effect for usability that the designer of the system, you know, may have thought, okay, this is sort of a nice feature. But if you could query that color, then you can learn more than, like, that wasn't the intent. Like, I didn't think that, no, you're not supposed to be able to, like, you know, learn that. Right? And so browsers have to defend against issues like this, right? And so this one maybe is, you know, there's a reasonably straightforward fix. which is just don't give away that information. So the webpage can write the script and ask for it, but like the browser just lies. And so there's not a way to differentiate that. Or just sort of make it so that, that the styling doesn't give away whether or not it was visible. So this is a more of a UI example. Does this make sense, by the way? Okay. But like a lot of these types of things, as we'll see, we can sort of generally, there's a way to maybe take it a step further. So this is one where just sort of observing the effect of the browser. But if we go back to the idea of timing and how long something takes, what if a particular website tries to write, tries to basically do a lot of computation? And in this case, a lot of memory access is trying to just like store a lot of data. Okay, maybe a little bit odd, but okay, I mean, that's something you could do in code, fine. Well, the issue is that what happens if how that works depends on what else is running on the machine? And this whole semester, we've been talking about sharing, right? We want to be able to make the illusion that multiple things are running at the same time when they're really not. Or we have multiple processors that are sharing some resources. And so again, multiple things are running, but they're not sort of running completely independently. It depends on what else is going on. And so what these researchers found is that depending on what else was loaded, basically what else the browser was trying to do, it would affect the timing of this writing this array. Which again, intuitively kind of makes sense. Right? If I'm loading a really simple website, well, that should probably happen very quickly, doesn't take many system resources, not going to interfere much. But if I'm running something much more complicated, well, that is going to take more system resources. And those are resources that I'm not getting in some way to do my loop writing. Right? And so you can see sort of the heat map here. Right? If we look at three different websites, the colors sort of correspond to the performance of this array. And so for a simpler website, relatively simpler website displaying more text, well, the loop was able to execute pretty quickly here. But something like the weather, right, which is displaying maybe like the radar, right, more complicated graphics that require more compute behind the scenes, that sort of distinctly slow down the operation. And not just in any sort of arbitrary way, but even worse, in sort of a predictable, repeatable way. Because again, the website's going to be kind of loading the same operation every time you view it. And so by observing the performance of one operation, that gives you an insight into what else is happening. So these kind of examples pop up, right, where the effect of one operation is observable and how it influences something. Questions on this? So the question is, will these timings depend on the machine that you're running on? And so will this only sort of work on a single device, or would it generalize if you have a different laptop, a different processor? And so your intuition is absolutely right. It's absolutely going to depend on the hardware, right? Because that's ultimately where the sharing is happening. It's also going to depend on other things that are happening in the system more generally. Maybe you're not just running a web browser. And so with these type of attacks, they're generally not sort of like, I just run it once and I can tell. Right? It's generally more of something like, I have to kind of get a feel for the environment. And then once I sort of get a baseline that can take care of those different platform-to-platform effects, then I can start trying to observe these signatures. So yeah, that's a good insight. And I think that leads to sort of another kind of takeaway here, where sometimes what we care about is understanding the risk. And then we as engineers have to make a judgment, right? Is this risk something that we are concerned about, where we should fix it, or not? Or something else in the middle? So sometimes we can look at things, you know, black and white, right? Like, okay, it's broken, we need to fix it, right? This test doesn't pass, we have to fix it. You know, this is a case where, yeah, maybe there are mitigations. But are those mitigations, generally speaking, are gonna come with some compromise, right? We're probably gonna slow something else down to make this harder to do. Is the performance worth it? Those can be hard questions, because now we're sort of weighing two different things. This is sort of a privacy issue, right? Can one website learn that I'm also viewing the weather? Well, that may be not intuitive. I didn't want that. But am I willing to slow down everything, potentially, to avoid that privacy leakage? Maybe I can answer that for myself. Does the browser author know how to answer that for all of its users? Maybe, right? So these are, you know, these types of issues kind of raise other sort of questions, which are not sort of the traditional, like, engineering, I need to build something. But like, design matters and trade-offs matter, and we're gonna have to weigh those, right? Decide what do we value? When does this become unacceptable? You know, when is the performance cost or whatever the trade-off is worth it? And when is it not? Okay, so what we've been talking about so far is this idea of a sidechain. Right? So these are all cases where we're observing what's going on somehow, something about the machine's operation or the user's behavior in some indirect way. Right? This isn't we're calling a system call and getting the answer. We're not reading a memory location to get the contents of the private key or the passphrase. Right? We're just sort of observing other indirect elements of the operation and doing it in a strategic way so we can figure out what's going on. Over time, researchers have sort of identified a number of these different types of side channels, some of which we'll talk about in this class. A lot of them boil down to this issue of timing, like we've seen, where depending on different operations, it caused certain things to execute at different times, and we can see that and then try to infer based on that. Another example that we won't talk about is sort of related, right, is the actual power draw of the device. So, of course, all of these processors and everything we've been talking about needs energy to execute, and that's not constant, generally speaking. Right, and we see this all the time, right? If our device gets warm, right? It's getting warm for a reason. Why? Because it's consuming more. It's either drawing more from the battery, right? Because the circuits are doing more, and so that increase, again, is proportional to what's happening in the device. And so that's another way to observe what's going on. And also, as we know from physics, the sort of the movement of electricity also creates electromagnetic radiation, and depending on the operation of the particular hardware device, that can have a signature that can be observable. And that can even be observable remotely. There's other types too as well, like sound. So like maybe the sound of a particular key being pressed, or the operation of that hard drive spinning around. again, can sort of reveal things. And the issue is not just that, like, this is sort of a neat way to learn something. The issue is that we can learn things which we want to keep secret, right? Whether for privacy or for security. Questions so far? What are you wondering about? All right, so far so good? Cool. So let's get a little bit closer to home here. So we spent a fair bit of time talking about caches. Remember, and the whole point of a cache was to hide the latency of memory. Well, what does that mean? That means that if things went right, our cache did its job, then we get something very quick, which is what we want. And if we couldn't cache it or it was evicted or whatever, well, then it's going to take longer, right? So if we observe, so we have some array here, right, and we read different elements of the array, and then we observe, how many CPU cycles did that take, right? Did it take sort of a small, handful because it was close by, or did it take sort of 4 or 5 times more? So why would it be different? Well, because if that element sort of was not in whatever cache maybe the other elements were, that caused it to be about the same latency, but everything else in that array was, right, then we're gonna see this difference. And so based on our discussion so far, right, this is a clear example where we have a timing difference. All right, I think we're cool with that. But I think the question is, okay, so what? Right, why does that matter? All right, so let's look at another example here. So, again, rough code to sort of fit on the slide. Right? So we have our array, kind of like we saw, right? It's a size. So our first operation we do here is we access the whole thing, right? And so what should that do? What would accessing the whole array do? Yeah. Okay, right. So it's gonna basically tell the memory system, like, I want to know all of the values in this array. That's gonna cause sort of a memory read to all of those relevant addresses. And what's, given the discussion so far, what's the relevant factor of that? It's not that we're trying to know if one of the elements is 7. Right? What's the effect of doing that? Yeah.
Seeing how long it takes to, how many cycles it takes to do that, to access all of your array.
Okay, so we could look at how long that's going to take. But we're not quite there. Right, we're sort of setting things up. So why do we have to, what is accessing this entire array going to do in terms of our memory system? Yeah.
Hopefully it will load most of it into the cache.
Yeah, exactly. Right, so because we're going through this memory hierarchy, at the end of the day, all of these things now should be in the cache. Because if there was something else in the cache, well, that's going to be evicted and replaced with this. And if it was already there, great, it's still there. And if the cache was empty, it will populate it. Okay, so we're basically sort of loading the cache here. Okay, now, something happens, right? And so here, for simplicity, we'll just say, there was some address that was accessed, and whatever memory was there is now incremented by 1. Okay. Fair enough. Now, what's our last step here is going to be, we're going to time, we're going to go back and access that array again, except this time we're going to time it. And so doing that, we notice that, well, you know, this particular array index took a lot longer than the other ones. Now, why would that happen? Well, it probably happened because whatever this was, right? Whatever this write to this other address, it went to the memory. It said, you know, I want to update this. It checked the cache. It found it wasn't in the cache. Why? Well, because we loaded the cache with all of our data. So it had to go out to main memory and then pull that into the cache, make the change. But the cache was full, right? Because we filled it. And so to make room for that, we would have to evict the element from our array, fill it with this other whatever this memory is at this other address, you know, update all of that, put that in the cache. Okay, great. And so then when we go and then look again, most of the things will still be in the cache, right? Because the processor doesn't want to just get rid of that, right? The whole point is to make it fast, except where this other access overlapped, right? That's what's slow. Okay. So given that, what do we know about other addresses? Let's take 2 minutes, or you got an answer already? All right.
I was thinking about it. Would it have okay. the same index, but a different tag?
Okay, so we have same index, different tag. Okay, so B and D. All right, so that's the proposal. Agree, disagree? So let's look at B and E here. Okay, so what about the cache index? So would it be the same or different or we don't know? Well, remember, index, the cache index is the cache sort of row we're changing. And so for the case to happen where we loaded something in there, we did something else, it was evicted so that it was slower, then we absolutely need that index to match. Right? So we definitely expect that. So it can be the same cache index. Now what about the tag? Right, the tag doesn't matter for which row. So how do we know that the tag is different? Yeah.
If it was the same cache tag, then it would be a cache hit, right? So then there would be like no eviction. So you need like a different tag to do something else.
Yeah, exactly, right? So that's exactly the understanding that it must have been different, because if it wasn't, then we wouldn't have evicted, right? And that operation would have been fast, and our lookup would have been fast as well. Now, what about the offset? What about over here? Are they the same? Yeah?
We don't know.
Right, this is the one we don't know. We don't know because we're just sort of being able to observe at that cache block size. Right, we don't know if it was, you know, which part of the cache block it's actually trying to access. If we don't know that, you know, we just know that it happened to be in the same index. Okay. Other questions about this? Are we good with this so far? Cool. Okay. So at this point, you might be like, okay, I kind of see it, right? You know, we've talked about caches. We know how they work. You know, this sort of makes sense. You know, but we're kind of looking at sort of two different things. We've got some sort of high-level code, and then we're talking about caches. And so as we've sort of mentioned with this, there is a bit of complexity here. It's not as straightforward as sort of we're going to explain on the slides for sort of to get the conceptual idea. Because caches working at the physical addresses, not virtual, but our programs are using virtual, so we're going to have to figure out the mapping there. But that turns out to be doable, especially since they're often predictable. There's going to be a lot of other things running. So like, you know, we just looked at like some for function calls, right? But like, we know that like that's going to require updating the stack or loading things onto the stack, popping stack frames, right? More memory accesses that are going to be present, that's going to change what's in the cache. And so just like when we talk about the browser example and like how different machines are going to affect it and different sort of other operations, we're going to have to try this a bunch of times. So we'll have to compare like with or without the access to try to identify what we're actually trying to observe. Processors are often trying to help us out and do something called prefetching. And kind of as the name sort of suggests, the idea here is that like if I access one part of memory and that loads something into the cache, what are the chances that maybe the program's going to access the next part of memory? Well, that seems like a reasonable guess, so maybe we'll pull that into the cache as well. And so that would hide in the effects, right? And so, but we can be strategic in how we're accessing the cache and doing different operations to avoid this. And not all caches might use just the index bits. Might use something like a simple hash function to determine like which row in the cache it should go into, which is going to sort of change how these, you know, how this is going to affect the different addresses. So, just to say, there is complexity here, and so if you've been kind of thinking about that, like wait a minute, wouldn't this affect it and that? You're right. For sake of illustration, we're going to sort of just kind of hide some of this, but the demonstrated, like the academic literature on this, I mean, definitely shows that it is possible despite these things. It's just real world implementations are going to be a little bit more advanced than what we can show on the slides. Okay, all right, that's kind of the disclaimer. Hopefully that's okay with you so far. But with that being said, let's look at another example. So again, we're looking at the effect of caching. Okay, so we have an array. We're going to allocate it in an aligned way like we did in the page table homework. Then we have some operation which is going to load that array into the cache, like kind of like what we saw before. Okay. Now, to sort of explain this block of code here. So if mystery, increment the memory point two by point or by one. So this is sort of a placeholder for some operation, something happening that we can't directly observe. So like, we can't just print the value of mystery. Because maybe this is actually like a function that we don't, you know, we don't control. We can just call it, something will happen. But we're not sort of actually like able to like edit that code, right? So when we're trying to do this attack, you know, we're writing this other code and then there's something, whether it's happening in maybe a different process or it's a function call or something we can't directly observe, but it's going to happen. So that's kind of what we're showing here. So based on some condition that, again, we can't see, it's going to change whether or not this memory is updated by one, sort of illustrate the idea. Okay. And then after that, we sort of get back to our observation point here, where now we're saying we're looking at timing a particular access to this memory array. And so if we know the address of pointer, and we know our cache structure, where should we look in the array to try to learn if this pointer, if this mystery operation has happened? Make sense? All right, let's take maybe 4 minutes, again, with the people around you. What's the right address to look at? Or the right index to look at? So what do we need to do to figure this out? So we definitely want to understand which bits are being used for which part of the cache. All right, so if we have 64 byte blocks, how many bits for the offset? Six, okay, yeah. So we have 2 to the 6 bytes for our blocks. And then what does that leave for the index? 9, all right. So we have 9 bits for the index. Okay. And then if we sort of zoom out for a second, so like conceptually what are we trying to do? Well, we know that if this pointer with with this particular address, if the memory was changed there, right? So if mystery was true, then that's going to change one particular cache row. And that's not going to match what we want. And so then when we do the timing, it should be a lot longer. Well, because our array is aligned to the size of the cache, what does that tell us about array zero? So this is going to have an index of what? If our array is aligned to the size of our cache. What's the obvious guess? Zero, yes, right. So index is zero. Okay. So we have that starting point. We also then have our pointer here. And so if we break this down, right, into binary, those are the lower 2 bytes. So we know our offset is going to start here. Right, okay, so that's our sort of offset. And so then we have our index is the next 9. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, so that's the index that's gonna use in the cache. And so we want, but then we know that, like, you know, I was only drawing out this part, right? So we know we have this tag over here. Right, so we'll have a different tag between our array. So we'll get the effect we want, which is good. And so what we want is we want the index to match and the tag will be different, right? And so to do that, we're going to ignore the offset bits. We can just set those to zero, but then we want the tag to match. Actually, let me make this a little clearer. Okay, there we go. And so then we end up with 0, this is 8, this is 1, and then 0. So OX. So this index, because again, our array started at index 0, will have the same index as the cache. And so that's the element we want to check. Good. All right. Okay, and there is a sort of another explanation here, breaking this down. Okay. Bit of an aside, but is going to be relevant in a bit. So, again, we're trying to model this as sort of this if statement here. And so we're somewhat directly observing whether or not this pointer was used to modify the memory, whether or not that happened, right? Because that's what's going to show whether or not our cache is a hit or not. But does it sort of actually tell us about mystery directly? Well, from a programmer's point of view, yes, right? Because if that memory access is only going to happen if mystery was true, right? That's what that if statement is going to do. However, as we know, with the processor designs that we actually use, the processor is going to try to predict whether or not mystery is true. And so might start running those instructions and then later find out that it wasn't, right? And so it's possible that with the branch prediction, it actually sort of speculatively started executing that before it figured out, like, oh, wait a minute, I wasn't supposed to do that. So it's another sort of one of these optimizations that's causing different effects. So there's a little bit of a subtlety there. We'll come back to that on Thursday. All right. Let's look at another example. Same kind of setup, right? We still have our array, and we're still populating that. Now, our operation is slightly different here. But again, we have some effect that we can't directly observe that's happening, but it's going to alter memory. And so if this other array is at this memory address, and then we find out that the index we care about is here, what was mystery? What did this mystery code actually, where did it actually index into this array? So it'll take a couple minutes. Feel free to work with your neighbors and then we'll go through it. Okay, so how do we figure out what mystery was. Well, again, we're still trying to do the same sort of intuitive thing, which is figure out, okay, how are these going to intersect the same cash row, therefore causing this effect where we see this timing difference? Well, we know, so we can figure out the relevant index from where in the array we saw the difference, right? And so if that's at OX 800, and in binary here, we have the offset and then the index. So we know our index must have been OX20 based on where in that array was the interesting thing. Okay? And so if the other array was at this address here, then where do we have to offset that to get into the same index? And so we can look at this. So the index here is 1, right? So the start of that array. And so we need to go enough in to make it so that we're going to add a 1 in that position so that we'll get to 2, the index we actually want. And so, oh, sorry. So X here, okay, it's 4, this is 2, 0. So if we go that far into the array, then we hit the same index. But notice, right, something interesting here, which is that because the lower bits are the offset, like, you know, if this was 1 instead, well, it would still be the same index. And so actually, we actually get sort of in binary that we want 0, 1, and then we can have different lower bits. So again, within the size of that cache row, or so the cache block, I should say, we can figure out where in that other array we must have access. So another view of this, right? We can figure out what the cache index is, and then the what this boils down to is if we start here, where do we have to index to get that same cache index? And so we need X to be here. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
So on the previous slide, when you say index, could you clarify like when you're talking about the index of the array and when you're talking about the index of the cache?
Okay. Right. So this index is the index of the cache. And then this index is the index into the array. So we know where we're into the array, and then that tells us where the cache index, so that needs to match. And so now I'm realizing that I'm off by 4 bits. So let's erase this. Okay, instead use this version, right? So numbers are similar, just a different bit. So yeah, so we have, this is our index here. Into the cache. And so to make that match what we want, index of 20, we need to add this here. And then these lower offset bits can be sort of anything because we'll still get the same index. So mystery, so X can sort of reign, it needs to have these bits, but then the lower bits can be different. Yeah, unfortunately, we like a lot of things in computer science, we use the same word for two related but different things. Okay. Now another, so far we've been looking at this, direct mapped cache. We could also have a associative cache, right? It's like that depends on what the hardware decides to do. And so this does complicate things a little bit, just because now there's sort of more places to put a particular a row or block. But that's okay, right? Just having that sort of extra bit of uncertainty doesn't completely change this, right? We still get, we still can do this with something like the structure here. So what do we need to do for these indices to have the same effect? So what has to be different about index, the result of index one and the result of using index two to make the same type of attack work? Yeah. Okay, so if they have different cache indices, then what's going to happen, right? So we have some cache that's got multiple rows, but we got two ways, right? So we can have two things. And so if like one index goes here and the other index goes there, maybe we, so now we can kind of check here and check here. But if our other access, right, this mystery operation affects, say, one of those cache rows, maybe it just goes over here, right, our mystery op. Now when we go back and do our timing, what's going to happen? Well, our thing is still in the cache, right, and so we're not going to see the difference. So what we want to happen is not that these go into separate cache rows, we actually want them to have the same index. So that instead of, say, going over here, our array access goes into that to both ways in the same row. What do we need for that? Yeah?
Different tags.
Different tags. Exactly. Right? So if those have the same index but different tags, then they'll end up in the same in both spots in the row, And so regardless of which one, the whatever the replacement policy is, whichever one gets evicted, you know, we still know which index it was at. And so this is going to be 2 to the 6, but now instead of having a 9-byte index, because of that, with the direct map, with the two-way cache, we're gonna have half the number of rows. So we'll have 2 to the 8 rows, and then that leaves 1 bit in our cache, sort of the upper bit of our index into the array to use as to differentiate the tag. And so we can have our 6 offset bits. Then we have our 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yep, our 8 index bits, and then we have the tag bit. So we want the index bits to match. So we'll have 1, 0. Oops. So we'll have this index for one of them with a 0 here, and then the same thing but with a 1. So that'll get us both ways in the cache. All right. So what we've seen so far is sort of a series of similar looking problems. And this was sort of generalized into this notion of a prime and probe operation. So yeah, the idea is we first prime the cache in a known way. We then do something, right? Whatever secret thing that we're trying to observe, or we cause that to happen somehow. And then we probe the cache to see what changed and see specifically what slowed. And this sort of originally came from an attack on AES, again, back in the early 2000s, where implementations of AES at the time, this is a symmetric encryption, were using a lookup table. And so depending on what your input data was and what the secret key was, which is what we couldn't observe directly, would change how that lookup into a table was happening. And so again, so we have... this is known, but this is secret. But then by observing, once they primed the cache, ran a bunch of encryptions with known data, and then observing how that changed the cache timing afterwards, they could figure out what the actual bits of the key were that were being used. And sort of an illustration of this here. So this is basically two plots showing the timing. And so again, we've been talking about sort of the complications of the real world. So the left-hand plot is showing for different vertical columns or the cache rows. So for different cache rows, they're seeing different timing. Darker is actually faster, lighter is slower. And as you can see, there's a sort of a lot of variation, right? Because there's other things going on. But when they do enough trials and can compensate for those and basically subtract out those effects, that's where they get the graph on the right. So the graph on the left is the sort of raw data, and then this is once you normalize it to sort of the baseline operation, and then this diagonal here that we can see becomes a lot more clear just from inspecting it, and that's sort of showing the effect of what the key was on the timing. And so the kind of effect of this is that cryptographic libraries have to be very careful not to be subject to these types of attacks. This is one of the reasons why people say, like, don't write your own crypto libraries, because you've got to make sure that you're getting all of this stuff, all the things we've learned over the decades of trying this, you have to get it all right. And that can be tricky. Okay, there's another example. In the slides here, but we'll leave that That's practice, and we will pick up here on Thursday, where we're going to get back to this idea of, okay, we've been looking at the cache, but what happens on these misprints? All right, see you on Thursday.